This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 8, Frying, Confit, and Deep Fat Poaching. Podcast found online at stellaculinary.com. My name's Jacob. Thank you once again for joining me. Today we finish our three-part series on basic cooking technique. We're going to be talking about deep fat frying, deep fat poaching, and the art of confit. And confit is one of my all-time favorite cooking techniques. And now that you actually, after listening to this episode, understand all the basic techniques and you got some good starches to serve and you understand how to make a stock properly, which is the basis to a lot of sauces that we're going to be going over. Starting next episode, we're going to be doing a five-part series on the French mother sauces because there are five French mother sauces. So each episode is going to be a mother sauce. And we're going to go really in-depth into the defining factors of that sauce, the technique behind it, and all that good stuff. But first, we're going to answer Dino's question on the difference between cooking oils and finishing oils in our discussion segment. So in today's discussion segment, I got a question from a listener, from Dino. And Dino asks, is there a reason why olive oil can't be used as a go-to oil for cooking? I see chefs like Gordon Ramsay, Bobby Flay, Emeril, Mario Batali, Tyler Florence, etc., who constantly use olive oil. I just thought that this was a standard oil for chefs. So that's a great question. And what it comes down to is the overriding theme of this podcast, obviously, is knowledge, right? And so all I can do is give you as much knowledge as I possibly can and, you know, try and talk about the science behind food and the science behind cooking and why you would choose one thing or the other, and then make your own decisions based upon that. There's many, many, many different chefs out there who cook things in completely different ways, and it's all about making informed decisions as a chef and a cook. So with that said, normally speaking, I do not use olive oil, especially extra virgin olive oil, when cooking. And the reason why is when you look at a nice bottle of olive oil, right? The reason why you're buying it is for these aromatic compounds that have not been filtered out yet. So extra virgin means it comes from the first pressing of olives and it hasn't been filtered. Virgin olive oil comes from the next pressing of olives, and then regular olive oil comes from a third or fourth pressing. And with both the virgin and the regular olive oil, they're filtering it more. And so the more you filter your oil, number one, the more of those aromatic flavor compounds you're taking out, which makes it a little bit more neutral. And also, too, those all the different particulate matter that is contained within the oil that gives it its unique taste is going to drop what we call the smoke point of oil. So when you're cooking with olive oil, it'll start to break down and smoke and have that hit that smoke point anywhere from around 325 degrees Fahrenheit to, you know, 375. And even that is not so much the case for a good extra virgin olive oil. It's going to have a lower smoke point because it's going to contain more particulate matter, giving you more flavor. Now, as you heat olive oil, you're going to change the molecular makeup of the oil itself, and you're going to start breaking down those flavors. Now, anytime you see your pan start to smoke when there's oil in it, it's going to, that's your sign, that's your signal that it's breaking down. That's going to give you some off flavors, and it can give you anywhere from like a sort of a fishy sort of flavor. Some oils, when they break down, they taste almost fishy. And then other oils will just give you sort of acrid, just off, burnt sort of taste. So for me, if I'm going out and I'm going to spend the money on a good extra virgin olive oil, I use it for what's called a finishing oil, right? And when I say finishing oil, you use it after the fact and you use it in a cold preparation. So if you want the flavor of olive oil in your dish, I would recommend first cooking with a more neutral olive oil. Again, this is just my opinion. This is my recommendation. This is how I approach my food. I usually cook with a 50-50 mixture of clarified butter and canola oil. And the clarified butter, when you're pulling out those milk solids, so now you just have the butter fat left over, it still has a nice buttery flavor. And the canola oil is there to mainly cut it. And it's the canola is also a neutral flavor. And so the smoke point of that combination is a little over 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So the whole purpose of that is to allow me to cook something at a very high temperature, whether I'm searing or sauteing, without getting any other flavors involved, right? So really what it's doing is it's giving you more control over the flavor structure of your finished product. So if you are searing a fillet of beef or, you know, a piece of salmon, and you want to have those nice aromatics of olive oil, maybe you're doing more of an Italian-inspired dish, then finish with olive oil. So once you have your composed plate and you put your finished product on the plate, you know, drizzle a little bit of that nice olive oil over the top, and you're going to get much more bang for your buck, because since you did not heat that olive oil, the flavor molecules are going to have a chance to break down and change. And so you're really going to get the full flavor and aroma of that extra virgin olive oil. And extra virgin olive oil isn't cheap, and there's some higher end ones that are, you know, more expensive than a lot of good truffle oils. So especially if you have a nice bottle of olive oil, I would recommend using it as a finishing oil. And really, again, it's just having control over your dish, right? So that's why I always recommend cooking with a neutral oil. My go-to neutral oil is canola oil. Some people like to use grapeseed oil. And then use your flavored oils, whether it's, olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, sesame oil, truffle oil, to finish your product. Now, there are some circumstances, I did mention sesame oil, where actually sesame oil has a fairly high smoke point, just slightly above 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and you'll see that sometimes used in cooking processes, especially in Asian food, and it gives a nice sesame flavor, but it's not going to break down like a nice high-end extra virgin olive oil. So, in short, save your nice, flavorful oils for finishing and your neutral oils for cooking. So on today's technique segment, we're going to continue on our course of basic cooking techniques, talking about frying, confit, and deep fat poaching. So let's go ahead and start off with frying. Now, frying is actually considered a dry heat method because there's no water involved. Fat is fat. It's not actually a liquid, technically speaking, even though when it's heated, it takes on a liquid form. So it is considered a dry heat method, which is going to allow you to brown foods in it. And also oil is a really good conductor of heat. And you can cook at high temperatures. You know, usually you're going to fry between 350 and 400 degrees. And that's going to give you a nice, beautiful crust. Now, there's basically two kinds of frying. There's shallow frying and there's deep fat frying. Now, shallow frying is just simply covering the bottom of the pan with anywhere from, say, a half an inch of oil or a quarter of an inch of oil, just enough to get a nice even contact with the oil on the crust of what you're frying. And some people will even, like when you're talking about southern fried chicken where they do it in a cast iron pan, you know, there's a couple inches of oil in there. But the real sort of defining factor of shallow frying is the fact that even though you're using the oil to fry your food or your product, it's still in contact with the bottom of the pan. versus deep fat frying, you totally immerse the product in oil or in hot fat, and it's completely surrounded by all sides on that fat. Now, frying is really used mainly for poultry and fish. Anything from catfish fillets to whole fried turkey, fried chicken obviously is very classic. And your cooking temperatures are going to range from about 300 degrees to 400 degrees Fahrenheit or around 150 to 200 degrees Celsius. Now, when you go to drop something into a fryer bath, whether you're using just a pot of oil or one of those big double basket fryers that you find in a restaurant, what happens immediately is a moisture starts to evaporate because it becomes superheated, becomes heated above the point of boiling. And you'll see this in the form of the little bubbles that kind of start bubbling to the surface. That's water vapor turning into steam and evaporating and breaking the oil surface. Now, the oil will cool because of this. So a lot of the times people will recommend, you know, if you're going to fry something at 350, you want to start the frying at about 375 or start with oil at 375 because then it'll drop back down to 350 and you're just going to regulate that with the temperature and by changing the flame level or the heating element to control that heat. Now, as the moisture starts to evaporate, it's going to recover and the heat is going to come back up to the original temperature. And so the best way to really regulate temperature, if you don't have an actual fryer with the temperature thermostat on it, I would recommend going out and buying a candy thermometer, which clips right to the side of pretty much any cooking vessel that you're going to use. But, you know, here you'd probably be using a, 6 to 8 quart stock pot, and it'll tell you the temperature immediately, and it'll rise and fall. And the nice thing is it's built, because it's built for, cooking with sugar, it's built to hold up to high temperatures, and it'll stay right on your pot, giving you a nice true reading. Now, one thing that's interesting is that the intimate contact with the oil itself allows the surface to dehydrate crisp and brown, giving you a reasonable window of time to pull the protein before it dries out. That's why a lot of times fried food is nice and moist, because there is minimal moisture loss in relation to how long it takes for the exterior to become brown and crispy, which, let's face it, that's the reason why you're frying something anyways, is to get that nice, crispy exterior. Now, a lot of fast food joints, especially like, KFC comes to mind, Kentucky Fried Chicken here in the United States, is a fried chicken fast joint. And they, fried chicken fast joint, you know what I mean. But they use special pressure cookers where they are allowed to actually fry things under pressure, right? So this raises the internal boiling temperature of water to around 250 degrees. Now, why is this important? Well, water boils at sea level at 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees Celsius. And so if you've ever cooked at high altitudes, you'll notice that your water boils at a little bit of a lower temperature. Now, why is this? Well, heat is nothing more than molecular movement, right? It's a measurement to it allows you to measure how fast molecules are moving. And at a certain point, molecules will basically want to shoot off, right? When they get too hot, they're going to want to shoot off and kind of escape the heat because their movement becomes too fast. Now, you see this in water in the form of steam. Basically, what happens is when you heat water, you have atmospheric pressure that's holding this water in, it's holding the steam down. And it takes a certain amount of energy or a molecular movement to break and fight against that atmospheric pressure. Okay, so at sea level, it takes 212 degrees Fahrenheit, which again is just nothing more than a measurement of molecular movement. It takes that much energy for that water to break and fight against that atmospheric pressure and turn into steam and escape into the atmosphere. So what happens is when they fry things under pressure, and this is the same concept as a pressure cooker, but it's a pressure fryer instead, it allows them to really simulate the fact that they're technically frying something below sea level, right? They put more and more atmospheric pressure by pressurizing these deep fat fryers, which allows the boiling point of water, in this case, in the form of juices contained within the meat, to be much higher. Now, because the boiling temperature is higher, it takes a longer time and more heat to evaporate that moisture out from the meat, giving you more moisture left over and resulting in a moister product at the end. So if you can get your hands on a pressure fryer, there are some home versions, and you like to fry things a lot, that is sort of a cool route to go. And if you're thinking about opening a restaurant that features fried foods, especially fried proteins like chicken or turkey or, you know, whatever, I would very much recommend looking into a pressure fryer. Now, let's real quick just touch on the overall process of frying anything, right? So we're talking about deep fat frying here. You're going to get a pot of oil going on your stove. You're going to have a thermometer. You need to be able to regulate your temperature, because you don't want your oil to reach that smoke point, which we were talking about in the discussion segment. Now, again, generally speaking, you're going to be frying between 350 degrees Fahrenheit and 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So that little window is just going to be just high enough to give you a proper crust on the foods that you fry. At the same time, not getting high enough to actually break down the oil and have that oil reach its smoke point. Now, for larger pieces of protein, you're going to want to fry them at around 325 degrees. This is commonly the temperature used for fried chicken or things of that nature. Now, once your oil comes up to the proper temperature, you're going to drop your product in. Now, this is an important step, okay, because a lot of people, they're scared of hot oil, which you should be, okay, because hot oil will burn you and it will hurt. However, people make the situation worse by they hold the product they're going to drop in the oil way too high over the oil, and they drop it in and they try and run, right? But the splash catches up with them. The oil splashes out. And if you're on, especially if you're on a gas stove, that oil can splash out and catch on fire, which causes a grease fire, and that's never good. But also, too, it's going to splash up on you, right? So the best way to do it is you want to very gently hold the product at one end, at basically at its longest point, so you have the furthest distance from the oil, and you want to gently dip the other end of the product into the oil and then slowly release it and let it drop in the oil. And doing that is going to give you a lot more control, and you're not going to have any splashback. So if you are really scared of the oil, you can use a pair of tongs to lower something in, but please don't try and drop it and run. Okay, because it's going to cause more problems than it prevents. Now, usually you're going to crust whatever you're frying with a protective coating, okay, because the high heat of the fryer will dry out those fibers, especially when you're talking about fish. It'll actually dry out those fibers in fish a lot more fast, and it's going to make it fibrous and chewy. So you can usually counteract this by, in the case of fish, a lot of times you either flour the fish or you drop it into a batter. Now, a really good way to have just a regular flour coating adhere to a piece of protein is you want to first salt the fish or the protein, whatever it is. Chicken can, you know, work too. And you're going to let it sit, you know, for about 20 minutes. What's going to happen is that salt's going to bring sort of a protein-rich liquid to the surface that's nice and sticky, and then the flour will adhere to it properly. Now, the proper technique for actually battering something, and we're not really going to talk about batter as far as how to make them, just because that's going to be in another episode. I'll probably just throw some batter recipes up on the website. But when you're actually going to batter or bread something, there's a proper technique, and you want to always have a wet hand and a dry hand. And what's going to happen is you're normally going to have flour, egg wash, which is just eggs beaten up, and your coating, whether it's breadcrumbs or batter or what have you. So in the case of just doing a dry coating, such as breadcrumbs or flour, you're going to go into the flour with your dry hand. You're going to drop that protein into the egg wash. You're going to pull it out with your wet hand, and then you're going to drop it into your coating, whether it's breadcrumbs or even more seasoned flour. Now, in the case of a batter, you will normally just drop it into the flour and then drop it into the batter. Now, some people like to do flour, egg, flour, batter, and that's just something that's going to come with you experimenting and finding out what works best for you. Now, one important note when you are making batters is you want to use predominantly flours that are low in gluten. And the reason why is because gluten is what actually, you know, allows those stretchy breads to form, right? When you knead dough, you're kneading the dough to develop that gluten, so it'll trap the gas as the bread rises and expands and bakes. but that will lead to a bready, chewy texture on your fried foods. And you don't want that. You want it to be nice and crisp and light. So what I like to use, I usually use a mixture of all-purpose flour and cake flour. And a lot of times I'll actually add in some rice flour as well, because rice flour is nice and crisp and it doesn't actually contain any gluten. So that's going to allow you to make a nice traditional batter and have a crispy exterior and not have that that fried, bready, chewy flavor, which is horrible. Now, after the frying process, you always need to drain your food properly. And the way you do that is usually either using a fryer basket, or you can use what's called a spider, which is just, you know, one of those metal round mesh things that allow you to, you know, skim things out of oil and water. And you're going to drop it onto paper towels. Now, at this point, when it comes out, this is when you need to season it and do that last final seasoning. As that crust is setting, this is when your seasonings will stick to it. So, I mean, your seasoning could be as simple as just some salt, maybe a little bit of pepper. Some people will make like a nice spice, like Cajun seasoning. But no matter what it is that you want to season or flavor your fried foods with, you need to do it directly when you pull it out of the oil, immediately after you pull it out of the oil, and as it's resting on the paper towels. Now, those paper towels are there to soak up any excess oil, which will, if allowed to sit and pool, will soak back into your crust, sogging out your crust and defeating the whole purpose of frying your food in the first place. And frying really is one of those beautiful things that every culture does their own variation on. You know, in England, you have the beer batters, and, you know, Japan, you have the tempura batters. In Asia, you have all sorts of, you know, rice flour batters, or just people dusting things with rice flour and dropping them in. Anywhere in the world you go, you can find people utilizing the deep fat frying technique. So don't overthink it. You know, hot oil, regulated temperature, you're good to go. That's really all it is. I'm going to throw on a couple of recipes into the episode 8 show notes. I got a nice standard tempura batter and a nice standard beer batter you can use. And also, too, in the I'm going to just shoot a quick little technique video on just simply, you know, flouring something and, crusting it with breadcrumbs and dropping it to the fryer. I think this week I'm actually doing a crispy fried bossa filet, kind of like an Asian-inspired interpretation of the dish. And I'll show you how I fry up that bossa filet. But once you see how to fry a piece of fish or a piece of chicken, it is fairly universal. And it's, like I said, one of the most widely used techniques out there. So go and have fun with it. Oh, and one last thing before I forget, and I don't want to leave this out of the episode. We were talking about oils, right, and how they break down in the discussion segment. So the oil that you choose is very important to your frying process. So normally in restaurants we use a canola oil that's manufactured to basically withstand high temperatures for long periods of time. So you can just go and get your standard canola oil at your local supermarket or one of those big retail stores that sells it in bulk. And you can use that, and you can reuse your oil. Now you'll notice as after time, your oil will start to break down after multiple heatings. And this, you can tell just because it's going to get darker and it's going to start to smoke when you heat it. So at that point, you want to throw it out. Now, the best way to dispose of oil is, I like to save my oil containers, just pour them back into that oil. Obviously, you want to wait till it cools. And then, screw the lid on nice and tight and then just throw it out with your regular trash. Also, too, if you a better scenario is find a local refinery that actually, like a biodiesel refinery, and what they do is they take vegetable oil or, just use cooking oil, and they refine it into biodiesel. So, that's the best case scenario. And actually at the restaurant, and a lot of restaurants, we have these oil receptacles for our spent oil that are provided to us free of charge by local biodiesel companies. And they come, they pick them up, they take them down, they recycle them, and they sell the biodiesel. So that's another great way to dispose of your oil. Now, traditionally, too, a lot of people like to fry in peanut oil. And peanut oil is a really great oil to use for frying. The reason why I don't use it in my restaurant is because there are a lot of peanut allergies out there. And peanut allergies are one of the more serious allergies, where people, they can die if just the vapors are in the air alone. So I find that it's just, you know, it's a lot easier for me as a chef to use canola oil. Although peanut oil for a long time was the industry standard until people really started developing a lot of allergies to it. Also, too, lard, just good old-fashioned lard, is one of the best things you can fry, and a lot of good flavor. And that's why McDonald's French fries, I mean, you remember, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, they're actually really, really good. And that's because they would, you know, take these big blocks of lard and melt them down in the fryer and, you know, deep fry in lard. But then, you know, McDonald's started getting pressured to be more health conscious because, you know, when you go out to fast food and you eat and you order like a Big Mac and fries, you're normally doing it to lose weight, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those healthy food options. So, I mean, God forbid they actually fry your French fries in lard and make them taste good. So now they're using like this zero trans fat, you know, BS oil, and their fries have never been the same. So that's just a little side note. So if you aren't health conscious, fry in lard, and let's be honest, if you're going to deep fat fry something anyways, it's not exactly going to be the healthiest meal you've ever eaten. Okay, so general rule of thumb, you want to find an animal fat or an oil that is has a high smoke point and is manufactured for frying. The easiest thing for you in the home and even in the restaurant is to get a modified canola oil or just a regular canola oil. And then if you want to do something a little bit more fun, try frying in animal fats like duck fat or lard. Now, speaking of animal fats, that's going to actually lead us right into our next technique, which is confit. And confit is such a beautiful, beautiful technique, and I love using it. Now, confit is basically a very general term, and we're going to kind of nail it down a little bit more and talk about the applications of that term. But it really comes from the French word confit. And please don't send me your emails. I know my French accent sucks, but it comes from the French verb confire, meaning to do, to produce, to make, or prepare. So it's a very generalized term. Now, confit was created out of necessity. Right, before modern refrigeration was invented, it was originally done with pork. And basically what people can agree on is, you know, every fall after you fatten up your pig, you know, the family would go out and slaughter it. You take the more tender cuts and you would eat them, you know, throughout the next couple of weeks. Some of those cuts you would, you know, salt and you'd hang and you'd turn into cured meats. And all the excess fat that was trimmed off of these cuts of meat would be rendered down. That fat could be used for cooking. Now, what they found is that if they salted the meat first, let it sit in salt overnight, and then, you know, rinsed off the salt and cooked it in its own fat, and then let it cool, the fat layer would actually solidify over the meat, and they could store it for an extended period of time down in their root cellars. Now, the reason why this is possible is, number one, you know, salt, it dehydrates things, right? So bacteria needs a couple of things to thrive. It needs a nice temperature zone, which is, you know, usually around 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 135 degrees Fahrenheit. We're talking about that danger zone, right? That's for bacterial growth. So it needs to be within that zone for a certain amount of time. All right. Also, too, it needs, just like any other living organism, it needs moisture to live. Okay, so salting something is going to dehydrate those bacteria cells. And number three, it needs oxygen and light. Okay, so capping your meat, so when you're talking about like a heavily salted meat, right, like a confit, and then you cap it in fat, that fat cap keeps oxygen and light from actually getting to the meat itself. Which pretty much preserves the meat. Now, there is a concern for botulism, which is actually an anaerobic strain of bacteria that can grow without the presence of oxygen and actually thrives in environments without oxygen. And that's why the addition of salting is added, because it actually kills the botulism if the botulism is there in the first place. So with that little overview, let's get more into the actual technique of it. Now, like I said, this was originally done with pork, and it's going to be with it's going to be with more tough cuts of meat that contain a lot of collagen. Think braising, right? Basically, you're braising in fat. Now, traditionally speaking, anytime you're going to cook something confit, when it's a protein, you're going to cook it in the same fat of that animal. So if you're doing pork confit, you're going to cook your pork and pork fat. If you're doing duck confit, you're going to cook your duck and duck fat, you know, so on and so forth. Now, this is just a classic approach to it, and it adds a lot more flavor, gives you, you know, the more rounded flavor of that animal. But you can use other fats. The only real sticking point, though, is you want to use fats that solidify at refrigeration temperatures, because you're going to refrigerate it and you need that solid cap so the oxygen and light doesn't get through and you can cure. All right. So to illustrate this process a little bit more, let's talk about my method for making duck confit, all right, which is a wonderful dish and one of my favorite things to make, serve, eat. It's amazing. So as a professional chef, I'm a big advocate of using the whole animal whenever I can. I think it's kind of cruel to take an animal's life and then just serve what is supposedly considered the premium cut, whether it's the breast or the tenderloin, and then basically just discard the rest of the animal. So when I serve duck on my menu, what I normally do is I'll order in a couple cases of duck, and I'll break them down into their separate points. I'll pull off the breast, and I'll pull off the leg and thigh portions and keep the leg and thigh portions attached. Then I'll trim down all the skin and all the fat, and I'll put that skin and that fat into a pot, and I'll usually just add just a little tablespoon of water to that skin, and then I'll cook it over very, very low heat for a couple of hours with a lid just to render out all that fat. Now I have some nice duck fat. Now, normally what I'll do then is I'll take it, I'll put it through a fine strainer a couple of times, and then I'll put that fat back on the heat because there will be a little bit of residual moisture content. So what you're going to do is you're going to, you know, crank up that fat. You're going to see it boil. And when it stops boiling and simmering with nothing in it, that's when you know all the moisture content is gone. Now, at specialty markets, you can actually go and you can buy duck fat. And when I do a confit batch, I actually, you know, do a large enough batch to where I still need to supplement with some purchased duck fat. So I'll get a little bit, you know, duck fat from my purveyor as well. So it works really well for me because what I do is I cut off the breasts, right? And I'll use the breasts that week for dinner service. And I'll run a, you know, a nice entree with, like, you know, a pan roast of duck breast, yada, yada, yada. That same day, I'm going to start the salting process, okay? And so for the salting process, all you really need is kosher salt. And then anything you add to that is just sort of gravy. Okay. A lot of people like to add a little bit of sugar to their salt. And usually it's a proportion anywhere from, 2 to 1 salt to sugar. And sometimes as much as 1 to 1 salt to sugar. But the thing is sugar is going to brown a lot faster than salt or anything else. So it can lead to problems during the cooking process. I personally, I don't actually add any sugar to my confit cure. What I do add is a little bit of sodium nitrite, which is a curing salt, and that's what gives meat its nice pink hue, right? That nice, the kind of like hammy looking color. And also too, it helps me, it allows me to cure my duck confit for a much longer period of time, which we'll talk about in a second. And it helps fight botulism, right? Because giving your paying customers botulism isn't really the strongest business model out there. So the proportions that I use in my cure, I'm not even really going to go over them. If you're more interested in it, shoot me an email or I'll post something. I'll post my cure recipe on the website, actually, in the show notes. But really, all you need is kosher salt to start your cure. And the way you want to do this is you want to get like a nice sheet tray and or, you know, some sort of, you know, flat surface pan, and you're going to lay down a thin layer of salt, and you're going to lay your duck leg and thighs on top of that salt, skin side up. You then can add some sort of aromatics. I like to add, I like to season with a little bit of white pepper. Also, I like to throw on a little bit of orange zest, just a personal preference of mine, and then a couple of sprigs of thyme on top of each piece of, duck leg and thigh. You're then going to cover that completely with salt. And this is important, okay? You're not seasoning this to cook, okay? You're seasoning this to cure. So when I say cover completely with salt, I mean cover completely with salt. You're then going to take another pan and place it directly on top of this pan. And then you're going to want to weight it down. Now, in the kitchens, we use, you know, big number 10 cans of coconut milk just because, you know, I use coconut milk in some of my dishes. And the weight of these number 10 cans is going to help to press out some of the moisture in the duck and, you know, really press that salt into the tissues. Now, if you're doing this at home, you can use anything from bricks to, you know, a couple of heavy pots and pans. Anything that will fit on top of that pan that will, you know, give it a nice, good, heavy pressure. Now, you're going to let this sit in your refrigerator overnight, and you can let it cure anywhere from 12 to 24 hours. Now, after that initial salt curing process, you're going to take the leg and thigh portion, you're going to run it under cold water, and you want to rinse all that salt off. And you want to really make sure that you rinse it very well, because there's already a lot of salt that was uptake in the actual tissue of the meat itself. So it's important to get that salt nice and clean. Now, once you have the leg and thigh portion completely rinsed, I usually just drain it off some paper towels for a little bit, pat them dry, and then you're going to put them into a cooking vessel that's large enough to fit all of your leg and thighs and then cover with fat. Now, the thicker the cooking vessel, the better, because you're going to have a more even heat distribution, heat transfer. All right, so at home, if you have a Dutch oven, this works great for the confit process. In a restaurant environment, I usually just use what's called a hotel pan, and it's basically an all-purpose cooking and serving vessel, and that's what I use to do my confit. But at home, I would recommend definitely using a Dutch oven or a roasting pan, but you can also do it in a pot. Anything that's going to fit in your oven and it's going to fit all of your proteins in it with the addition of fat to cover, you're good to go. So you're going to cover it with your fat, and if you're using cold animal fat, you're going to want to heat it up first on your stove just to where it melts into a liquid form, and you're going to make sure that your protein is completely submerged in this fat. And then what you want to do is, I like to cover it, and some people cover their confit, some people don't. And the reason why I cover it is because what happens is, during the cooking process, some of that the moisture in the meat will evaporate into steam. And what's going to happen is going to hit the top of that lid, and it's going to condense back down and drop back into the oil, and it's going to leave you more confit jelly at the bottom. And confit jelly is this nice, beautiful gelatin that's left over at the end of the confit process, which we'll talk about in a second. But suffice to say, either way, you can cover it like I do, or you can not cover it. But bottom line, your protein has to be completely immersed in the fat. From there, you're going to put it into a nice low oven, okay, low temperature oven, the same temperature as if you were braising, okay? Because again, this is just braising, but in fat instead of liquid. So for me, I usually start my confit at around 250 degrees Fahrenheit, and I just let it ride for about, you know, 6 hours, you know, and that seems to be the magic little point. But really, your confit, just like a good braise, should be falling off the bone tender, okay? And so you want to, you know, at around the 4 or 5 hour mark, just take a little peek, you know, wiggle the bone. But be careful, because when done properly, just the slightest wiggling of the bone on the duck leg will actually detach that bone, and all the meat will kind of shred off. Now, once your confit is complete, and once it's nice and tender, you're going to transfer it into a storage vessel, and the only two things you need to worry about is the storage vessel is, assuming that it's large enough, obviously, to fit, you know, the confit and the fat. You want it to be nice and clean, and you want it to not be see-through, okay? Because light will break down fat extremely fast, right? And we're looking for a long-time cure. So anything that any container that you have that's not see-through, that's nice and clean, you're going to gently pull out that leg and thigh portion, and you're going to put it in this container. And then I like to add just one small little extra pinch of salt. And this salt is going to be my barrier between, basically my insurance policy against botulism. You're going to take that hot fat, and you're going to pour it over your protein product, again, making sure that it's completely covered. And you're going to store it in your fridge. Now, what's going to happen is, as this fat cools, like we talked about before, it's going to form a cap over the top of your protein, which is going to be a barrier between oxygen and light getting to your meat, which is then going to allow your meat to actually cure. Now, once your fat has completely cooled and solidified, I recommend covering it. You can just cover it with some tin foil or whatever, just because that top layer of fat will, over time, oxidize and will be broken down by the light, which can, you know, turn your fat slightly rancid. Now, this was actually one of those favorable features, right? When you're doing old school French confits, they would store them in their cellars for around 3 months, right? And the fat would naturally just break down and get slightly rancid, and that was part of the flavor, right? So I don't recommend you doing that, but that's just, you know, how it was done in the past. Now, generally speaking, the longer you allow your confit to cure in the fat, the more flavor and complexities it will develop. Now, I recommend curing your confit for no less than a week, and trust me, it will be very hard to do because you're going to be aching to, you know, bust into that confit and eat it. But, you know, no less than a week, and unless you're using curing salt, you know, like I was talking about sodium nitrate, and again, I'll have my cure recipe on the website, but unless you're using curing salt, don't cure your duck for any more than a month. Now, I've successfully cured duck without curing salt for up to 3 months, but I know what to look for, and I mean, go ahead and try it, but just, you know, my legal department doesn't really allow me to recommend it. So, you know, cure for, you know, 1 week for maximum flavor and up to a month, but I would recommend using it after a month. And honestly, I mean, if you have to have some major willpower to hang on to a nice batch of duck confit for more than a month, because you're going to want to get into that. Now, when you're ready to actually serve and eat your duck confit, you want to get your oven cranking. You know, you want to basically, I always turn my oven up as high as it can go. And actually at the restaurant, I'll crisp my confit in the wood fire oven, which we usually keep at around 800 degrees. And it, you know, gets that skin nice and crisp really fast. Now, the reason why you want to crisp it at such a high temperature is because you don't want it to dry out during the crisping process. So if you're cooking it really slow in the oven, by the time it's nice and crisp, all that juice is going to, you know, basically dehydrate out of the whatever the protein is you're using, and it's not going to be any good. So what you want to do is, you know, a couple hours before you're looking to serve your confit is you want to pull out your storage vessel and you want to let it sit in a warm place in your kitchen. What's going to happen is the fat's going to soften and you're going to be able to reach into the fat and pull out a piece of your confit. And there's still going to be some, you know, some of that fat's going to be coating the protein. You're going to drop that onto a sheet tray or a sizzle pan or whatever sort of pan you're, or cooking vessel you're using, and you're going to pop it in your oven. You're going to roast it for about 10 to 15 minutes until it's a nice, crisp, golden brown. Then you want to serve and you want to eat, right? And a lot of the times it's accompanied with you know, some simple potatoes or some root vegetables that are roasted in the fat that was used to confit, just to kind of marry all those flavors. And, oh yeah, I forgot to talk to you about the confit jelly. So after the cooking process, right, when you're straining that fat into your storage vessel, you're going to notice that there's going to be a little layer of liquid at the bottom of your pan. And you're also going to notice this too when you go and you take your long cured confit. There's always going to be this sort of this gelatin layer at the bottom, and what this is the meat juices, you know, that basically are dispersed out into the oil during the cooking process, and then as the confit cools, obviously oil and water don't mix, so they separate, and the water-based gelatin drops to the bottom, and you get what's called confit jelly. And this is extremely flavorful, salty meat jelly, and it's really great for finishing a pan sauce. So if you're doing a pan sauce for your confit, you can drop in a little gelatin right at the end, or drop in a little bit of that jelly right at the end to thicken it and to add some body and some flavor. Also, too, it works really well in a warm vinaigrette. Now, don't worry too much if you don't really understand how to make a vinaigrette or a pan sauce, because that's going to come in our sauce making episodes in a couple episodes down the line. But that that confit jelly, you definitely want to try and save that, because that has a lot of flavor and you can do a lot of fun stuff with it. Now, remember how last episode we were talking about braising and poaching, right? And this episode, you know, confit is pretty much related to braising in the fact that you're braising, but you're using fat. You're still doing that low and slow cooking process. Well, deep fat poaching is just like that, where it's related to the poaching process, where instead of using a tough cut of meat and cooking it low and slow, you're going to be using tender cuts of meat for your deep fat poaching. Now, there's a couple of reasons why you want to use the deep fat poaching process. Number one, it adds great flavor, right? Flavor is fat. Biologically, we are programmed to like fatty foods, because the more fat you can store for the lean months, the better chance you have of making it through winter, which is not quite as large of a concern as it was, say, 1,000 years ago, right? So with deep fat poaching, it also has a higher, fat has a higher density than water, right? So it actually, it'll hold in the moisture in the product that you're poaching. And it's also great for resting meats, right? Because of that higher density, if you cook a meat first, whether you're, you say you're pan searing it or you're pan roasting it, and then you're dropping that into a poaching liquid, but instead of using a poaching liquid, you're dropping it into a fat that is holding it at a nice temperature. As that meat rests, it's going to hold in all of that moisture content and all of that flavor. So this is a really great technique for a couple of things. Number one, you know, doing shellfish this way, or doing just any sort of seafood this way, is really spectacular. You're going to, say you want to poach lobster, you want to poach some shrimp, or you want to poach a fillet of salmon. You can do this in butter, you can do this in a flavored olive oil, or you can do it in animal fat. And you're going to be using the exact same poaching temperatures that we talked about last episode, you know, 160 degrees to 180 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're going to slowly, slowly sort of poach your meat for about anywhere from, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. And again, this is going to hold in your moisture content. All right. And another way to do this is, I love doing this when I'm cooking, say, a pork tenderloin or a fillet of beef. We remember back a couple episodes ago, we were talking about pan roasting or roti. When you are finished pan roasting and you're hitting that nice mid-rare temperature on your pork tenderloin or your fillet, you know, it's really nice to drop it into, say, a clarified butter bath, or even just a melted butter bath that you're holding at around 140 degrees. That's 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is going to allow you to go and, you know, complete the rest of the dish, put the rest of the dish together, and then right at the last minute, put your protein on the plate. And that added flavor from the fat is going to bring a lot to the table. But it's also going to allow those juices to redistribute themselves during the resting process into that meat, giving you a much more tender piece of meat. And that's really it. That's all I have to say about deep fat poaching. We covered so much on the actual poaching process in last episode, in episode 7. If you didn't listen to that episode, I mean, all these episodes are you know, put in a sequence to build upon the last one. So instead of going back and rehashing all the technical information behind poaching and all the science, if you haven't listened to episode 7 yet, I would highly recommend you do. And then basically take those techniques and apply it to poaching in fat. So in today's question and comment segments, I had a couple of questions I carried over from last episode. Now, one was from Mark, and Mark basically asked the same question that Dino did about specialty finishing oils and cooking oils and the difference between the two. So we pretty much knocked that out in the discussion segment. So Mark, I hope that answered your question. If you have any follow-up questions, go ahead and send them my way. You can always email me, jacob@stellaculinary.com. Now, the next question came from Mecca, and Mecca said, "You mentioned using clarified butter. What is the best way to clarify butter? I've tried it, and I ended up with brown butter, which is actually pretty good on brown rice, or I ended up burning my butter altogether." Okay, so clarified butter is one of those things that's actually a really great tool in the kitchen. Again, you can use clarified butter for the deep fat poaching process or for resting meats in it. And I actually, stated before, I like using it in a mix, 50-50 clarified butter with canola oil. And that's my all-purpose cooking medium, right? So I'll use that for sautéing, searing, pan roasting, all that good stuff. Now, the best way to do it without burning is to clarify it in what we call a double boiler. And all that is you basically take two pots that fit together. Now, in the restaurant, we use what are called bain-maries. And they're basically these cylindrical round vessels. They're not exactly pots because they're a little bit thinner, and they fit snugly into one another. And they usually leave about, you know, a 2-inch gap between the bottoms. So on the bottom of bain-marie, you're going to add, you know, about 2 inches of water. And then you're going to drop the insert on top. And that's where you're going to add all of your whole butter. Now you're going to heat this up over, you know, medium high heat. And what you're going to notice is the butter is going to separate. And there's going to be a froth that forms at the top. Now, what a lot of people do is they start skimming this froth, and they skim constantly. But what's happening is this froth is actually going to rise to the top, and as during the cooking process, it's going to collect and then dehydrate itself and sort of collapse back down, giving you a collapsed layer of milk solids on top of your oil. Then what you want to do is you want to just go back and you want to skim those collapsed milk solids off of the top. And you're going to notice you have a nice, clean, clarified butter with some more milk solids that are attached to the bottom of the pot. You're then going to take this clarified butter and you're going to pour it off. I usually pour it through a cheesecloth just in case there's any extra, you know, milk solids left over. And you're going to pour the clarified butter into a reserve container where you can store it. And you want to, you know, be very careful when you're pouring it out because you don't want to get those milk solids at the bottom mixed into your clarified butter because those are just going to burn and brown during the cooking process, and you're not going to have a nice high temp clarified butter. So once you have your clarified butter, and I do have a technique video on this. I'm going to link it into the episode 8 show notes. So head on over to stellacolonial.com and watch the clarified butter technique. And it's really simple. It's like a 2-minute video. And it really is a simple technique once you understand it. And this clarified butter, it'll actually hold at room temperature for a couple of weeks. And it'll pretty much hold indefinitely in your refrigerator. I mean, I've never stored clarified butter for more than 2 months in my refrigerator. Now, one thing when you do store fats is you want to make sure that it's in an airtight container because fats will absorb other aromas in your refrigerator. And you also want to make sure that it's in not only an airtight container, but a container that light can't shine into because, like we talked about before, oxygen and light are the two main enemies. So of fat, it's going to break it down the quickest. So if you store your clarified butter in a cool place with an airtight lid, you're good to go. And that'll keep for, you know, at least a couple of months. But, you know, just do small batches at a time and try and use them within a month. Now, one last quick thing before we end the show. Clarified butter is what I consider to be a basic prep technique, and I'm actually working on a video series to be released in iTunes and also on the website, which is going to be a video series on basic prep technique in a professional kitchen. This is going to give you a good starting point to where if you want to get a job in a kitchen, you know, the basic entry-level position is a prep cook. And it'll give you the tools and the information you need to learn how to knock out that basic prep using proper technique. But also, too, if you're just, you know, if you're a home enthusiast and you just want to make great meals at home, it's going to show you how to prep a large array of products using professional technique to get the best yield, which means the best bang for your buck, and also to get the best quality and to maintain that quality throughout the prepping and cooking process. Now, I've shot 10 videos on the for the basic prep technique video series already. I just haven't had a chance to edit them down yet, but they will be available shortly. So keep on checking back to stellacolonial.com. And again, like I said, they will be available in iTunes, and they will be released in HD quality, so you can, you know, stream them through iTunes in HD. Also, too, if you want, just make sure you're staying up to date on all of the Stella Culinary videos. Head on over to YouTube and check out our YouTube, and it's a just youtube.com/stellaculinary, and every single video that I release will show up on that YouTube channel as well. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you once again for joining me. Stay tuned for next episode where we start our 5-part series on the French mother sauce. We're going to be leading off with hollandaise and how to use egg yolks as an emulsifier and thickener. Questions, comments, check out our forum, stellacolonial.com/forum. Shoot me an email, jacob@stellacolonial.com. And until next time, this is Jacob with the Stella Culinary School Podcast, reminding you to cook with passion.